Do you think about where the songs land and how they're experienced in people's lives?
No. I don't.
People, I'm sure, share those moments with you. Is it creepy or what is it?
No, it's not creepy at all. It's just somewhat miraculous because amidst all this sort of turmoil and messiness and what was my anchor, you know, it was music, it was records. And so there's any number of artists I could go up to and go, oh, this song got me through. So just to think that I played that role in somebody else's life doesn't get much better, you know.
I was going to ask about influences. Can you recall an album or two?
It's
done tons, I'm sure, but maybe just that at moments in time did pull you through.
I'm trying to think of what was before the Beatles.
Was there anything? No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know if there was for me. I mean, there had to have been, but in terms of records and buying.
Well, you wrote that in that solo book that you were in fourth grade. That was the first album you bought, and that nothing killed you before then.
But. Yeah, I mean, actually, in fourth grade, I bought Rubber Soul, so I must have bought Meet the Beatles before then.
You were born in 56?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my age, too, so that's about right, though. Yeah.
I mean, I listened to a bunch of Beatles stuff at a girlfriend's house because she had older brothers and sisters. So by the time I started buying stuff, they had a few records out. And before that, it was like church music and stuff. I'm trying to think if there was a big song for me. We didn't even really have pop radio in South Dakota. And then when we moved to Canada, we moved to a town big enough that we had a top 40 station. But Magical Mystery Tour was out by then, so I was already, you know. So the Beatles, you know, the first record and Rubber Soul, I have very specific memories of listening to those.
I was going to ask you this at the very end of the interview, but since
What's
we're up? Here now, I'm working on a program for release next year on Revolver because it's a lot of musicians. And actually some top 100 things have listed it as, you know, Beatles' best. I'm wondering if you recall being impressed with it or thinking about it. I could remind you about some of the songs on it. Because my goal is to have musicians I'm talking to between now and then to each pick a song or two to relate to.
You know, I have to say, first off, there's no Beatles record out there that I don't know every word to every song. I don't have the exact memory of buying Revolver. I have a memory of examining that cover, you know, and the back cover where they're all wearing sunglasses, right? And Taxman. I mean, it was a huge record for me. I just don't remember actually getting it. Yeah, I don't remember. Like, I remember buying Rubber Soul, and I remember buying Meet the Beatles. I mean, you know, so it was Taxman, Eleanor Rigby.
Yellow Submarine, For No One, Tomorrow Never Knows, Dr. Robert. This is on the British version, but She Said, She Said. Sort of
I'm Only Sleeping.
Yeah, Here, There, and Everywhere. There was this. What are you laughing about? This
just, you know, I feel like an old fogey, but I was just talking to somebody. Oh, I went over to Jody Denberg's, the program director for KGSR, the station we were talking about, and he lives just right around the corner. He's a good friend of mine, and I went over there the other day, and Jody just invested in the big Saran thing, and he got that 5-to-1, that mixing 5-to-1 thing. You know what I'm talking about? That new way of...
Yeah, surround sound 5.1.
Yeah, 5.1.
Sound, yeah.
And Yellow Submarine came out on a 5.1 thing. So, and Jody's the biggest Beatles fan that ever... He's responsible for my meeting Paul McCartney. who's the only Beatle I've ever met. And he went out and bought Yellow Submarine, and I went into his house, and you know, he was playing it, and and he got a Sharp Aquos flat screen too. So I mean, it was like, whoa, you know, it was Saturday morning, and I felt like we were in college, and we're semi hungover, and should have been like smoking dope and going, oh. And I just felt it again, and I turned to Jody. I said, "Weren't we lucky? I mean, weren't we lucky?" And I just sound like an old fool, you know, because every generation's got somebody like that, you know. But when you talk about an album like Revolver and you list those songs like that, that's one record, and it's outrageous.
It's 35 minutes long.
The record?
Yeah, all 14 songs, which we didn't even get to hear. So. First time through. Is there a song though that
from Revolver?
That you'd want to say anything extra about that?
Sorry, I just can't, like, I think of all of them and it's like, whoa.
Yeah, they're all fun in a lot of ways. So
it's just to me, in a way, it kind of breaks down to the guys. I mean, you know, I mean, Taxman was brilliant, and George, we all know, has been, you know, somewhat underrated, and that's just like a nasty ass great song, great guitar playing, and that, you know, Here, There, and Everywhere and For No One were staples in my set at a certain time in my life, you know, the McCartney perfection, and I'm Only Sleeping is like John at his introspective, beautiful best, you know.
Talk a second more about that song. Nobody's so far talked about I'm Only Sleeping. When I wake up early in the morning.
It's just so John. I mean, I remember reading interviews with him where he talks about it, you know, and you can just, I don't know, I just get a real picture of, it's, you know, that song is the song, and I love it, but for some reason I just get a real picture of him, you know, just kind of internal, great mind, you know, watching the world go by, and just songs that he has that are kind of like across the universe, and just these songs that feel so internal and floaty, you know.
And a respect for the sleep stage, I think, which...
Or the semi-sleep stage, you know, which is... To me, that's kind of what it is. It's like he's not all the way asleep, but he's floating, you know, float downstream. And it's where creativity comes from, in a way, really, you know, deep stuff.
Well, thanks for humoring me about
not
that.
Not at all.
Again, I don't want to, I want to sort of be conscious of my time with you here and don't want to leave a few key things
okay.
undone. And so... Other influences, since we're sort of in that ballpark, you know, I've read, you've obviously mentioned Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, Paul Simon. Maybe a word or two about each in terms of their spot in your creative development. And then
James Taylor, Jackson Brown, also very, very important. Well, Joni Mitchell, and Richard Thompson and, you know, sort of what I call him, the second wave. Joni Mitchell was just, again, I feel so lucky because as a female role model, she was indispensable, you know. But that short sells her to some degree because female or male, she's one of the best we've ever had. So how, you know, I was 14. When some girl at church camp, some 16-year-old girl at church camp told me to get Clouds. And that was the newest record she had out at the time. So that was her second record. And so I did. So in terms of women, which I think was vitally important for somebody like me, you know, there was Laura Nyro and there was Joni Mitchell. And I still think they're both geniuses, you know. But Joni played the guitar. And wrote you know, in comparison to Laura Nero, wrote a little more literally, you know. I mean, Laura Nero could be out there. So that gave me somewhere to go. It gave me somebody to idolize, and I did. And I learned everything, you know. I learned the tunings. I just learned it all. And in fact, I mean, it was kind of a liability for me. I had to, it was such a major part of who I was, I kind of had to back off from it at some point.
You mean imitatively?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I wanted to sound exactly like her. And did a pretty good job, you know. I mean, I'm a good mimic.
Yeah, so was Ray Charles, too. So I'm going to come back. I'm sort of picking up threads here. I want to come back to influences. But then let's talk about the voice, because when I ask people if they know Sean Colvin's music, if they say yes, as many do, I say, what do you like about her? And they say that voice. And I'm just wondering if you have a conscious awareness of what's attractive, particular, engaging about how your voice comes out.
I have an awareness of it. It's not a conscious awareness in terms of using it when I sing. But Leventhal has made me aware of it, only in that I know there's some kind of longing, I think, is the way he put it, is the best way that he put it. It's not a gritty voice, although I've tried and it doesn't work. I think there's longing in it. But, you know, most singers only see the things that they don't like about their voice. And I've always been struck about how Chrissy Hynde can't stand to hear herself sing. And to me, she's just got one of the great original voices. And, you know, it's not just that it's original and she's making do with a limited, you know, range or something. I mean, I just think she's a great singer, you know, period.
So what they tell me, though, is I often hear purity, crystal, you know, clarity.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as any good folk singer should have, you know.
Yeah, but they don't all have it. But
No, but that's, you know, Judy Collins was big for me. My parents, there we go. That's before the Beatles. My parents had some Judy Collins stuff, and she was an interpreter, so that gave me hope. Although she wrote some pretty cool stuff, like My Father was a really cool song. We all learned that in high school. Mm. She had a really great record called Whales and Nightingales that was, to me, like really epitomized her whole folk deal. And it was a little more complicated and interesting. And I had a chance to meet her, actually, recently and talk to her about it. It was cool.
You know, your list of anybody's influences in music, I guess, go pretty deep, but... since we just have a little bit of time left, mm-hmm. do you want to elevate
anybody?
One or two that would sort of be the essential list?
It's tough.
And then just say a moment or two about each that you want to do that to.
Well, the Beatles, obviously, Joni Mitchell, Laura Nero, we've talked about them.
I keep hearing Paul Simon.
Paul Simon's really huge, and the longer that he's around and that I'm around, I just am more and more impressed by him. And not the least of the reason being that he's just continued to do such great work, you know, year after year after year after year. And not everybody does. I mean, just not everybody does, you know, but he's found new things to try. And just the catalog, it's like, it's unbelievable. And I mean, Dylan too, but there's something about Paul Simon. Just the records, the production, the ideas, the lyrics, you know, he's got some range, you know, just exquisite stuff, you know, more urban and some good urban feels, you know, in the stuff that he does, just great rhythms. The band, really huge for me and kind of my education into the looser side of things, you know. When I finally let the band in, it was a big revelation about being sloppy and the beauty of being sloppy. and doing it right, and the beauty of sloppy vocals and sloppy harmonies. And I mean that in the best way, you know, loose, you know, the heart, you know, the feel being more important than the purity or the perfection.
And then several of those, when you talk about Joni, Dylan, Paul Simon, you know, there's a trajectory to these artists that has seen them take their chances, take their lumps, go through periods of, you know, criticism and acclaim, and but it's been a real long road.
Yeah. Well, yeah, sure. I would like to see that for myself. Yeah, I would like to. I don't really. And I don't know if that's just accuracy or false humility. I don't know. I just see myself as kind of having started late with some handicaps, you know, and that's just a level I'll never reach. But,
well, and the rules of the game and the are changing too. It's funny.
Yeah.
I watched this film about, I don't know what baseball fan you are, but I watched Billy Crystal's film about Roger Maris and breaking Babe Ruth's record of home runs.
No, I haven't seen it.
And they, one of the points was that, you know, Roger Maris was saying, Babe Ruth never had to fly to the West Coast to play games, never had to play night baseball. You know, it's like, why are you trying to compare these records?
Oh.
You know, and I thought about that in terms of, you know, comparing a Sean Colvin career to a Joni Mitchell career. You can't, because, you know, even this business about you know, what the radio environment is like when a record comes out, the media is changing quickly now. It's just so much more quickly than it did in that period of time.
Yeah, I mean, in the time when the artists I'm talking about were releasing records initially, I mean, radio wasn't even a factor so much, really. Joni Mitchell, I mean, I didn't hear that on the radio. And what you were expected to sell was certainly different, you know? It's different.
When I saw your show, I don't know if it was a singular event, but you talked at length about this James Hollis book that I ran out and bought. You know, it was right for me at the time, too. That's just this circumstantial, but... and I'm just curious what it is about his take on things that was compelling, and whether or not it's starting to show up in writing work, because of their themes for, you know, intelligent music for middle-agers, you know. That,
yeah. Uh-huh. Well, see, that's what Graceland is to me. That was like, and it's sick because it was 20 years ago. But there's a guy who wrote about middle age, and it was deep, and it was interesting, and it was funny, and it was vital, and, you know, that's what that record means to me, on, you know, now more so than back then. Well, that book was, it just kept saying a lot of the same things over and over again, but in a very intelligent way, and so that every time I read something in it, it resonated with me, and it wasn't a pandering self-help book, you know. It was smart. I mean, the guy's a Jungian. He went deep, you know. What I really appreciate about that book is it was smart and it didn't pull punches, you know. It was sort of like, I guess I tend to feel things rather extremely, and this was sort of like letting me know that made sense, or that I wasn't overestimating this stage in my life, that it was big, you know, and just the depth of confusion I was feeling. The book sort of provided some relief, because it was kind of saying what I liked. Here was the kind of the totally concise little thing that I got out of that book. It was your adolescence, you're kind of, oh, sorry, you're kind of dreaming about who you can be. Your, you know, 20s and 30s and 40s to some extent, you're proving who you can be. And after that, all you really have left is just to be who you can be, you know. You're done with all of the others. You've dreamt it. You've tried it. Some things you've done, you've achieved. Some things you've failed at. It's all been about sort of defining oneself through actions, and it sort of begins to lose. That only goes so far. And you start to think about who you really are and who people are going to remember when they think about you. You think about mortality and I don't know, that's sort of like, that seemed refreshing to me. Instead of things seeming like they were over, there seemed something, like there was something very essential that had yet to happen.
Right. He talks about a first adulthood and a second adulthood.
Yes.
First adulthood, 12 to 40 maybe, you know, where you take your expectations of adulthood and try to be an adult, like you were saying.
Yeah.
And so it does, and, you know, in fact, when I heard you talk about it and reflect on your work and her last album, Whole New You, well, she hadn't even read that book yet then, but that's sort of a theme.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to be emerging and maybe in a hopeful place. For all of us,
and becoming a parent was kind of part of that. It's almost, I think, if you're parenting appropriately, to some extent, you're passing the torch. You know, I mean, you don't give up who you are, but you're sort of in service to somebody else. You know, I just think you have to be, and I think that started it. For me, and just part of the reason Whole New You began to go there, and there was something really fruitful happening, but I could not really do it justice, you know. So I just floundered along. So I like to see it as one of my, what you were talking about before, as sort of one of my missteps. But you know, we're allowed less of that now too in this day and age of sort of like having your less than brilliant, you know, work. And you kind of have to have some of those to get to the next place, you know. But I put it out too quickly, you know, because if you have a record, like a few small repairs, there's a lot of pressure to get something else out there. And that made sense to me. You know, I kind of wanted to get something else out there, but I sacrificed something.
Well, there's a lot of moments on here that I know a lot of your fans do appreciate. And as we're wrapping up, maybe we should just mention a couple tunes or let you talk about any that you do feel good about, you know, on here.
Yeah.
New Thing Now on here?
Mm-mm, that's on A Few Small Repairs.
Okay.
There's bits and pieces of a lot of stuff I like. Matter of Minutes, I feel like, works as a whole song. And I enjoy playing it. And Nothing Like You, I think, works. I enjoy playing that. And Whole New You, I actually started to play a lot. And just as kind of a fun song to play, it's working, you know.
Is did John write the music for Nothing Like You? Did he have the little lick that rolls around through there?
Uh-huh. Yeah. He just had a track with the... with that guitar part, and I might have had a little bass and drums or something on it, and I loved it. You know, it was springtime, I remember, and I would, I had the baby, and I would go out in the car to listen to the track, because that was my office. Gives you a sense of kind of the handicaps I had during that time, but I would go out in the kind of the late afternoon, and breeze be blown, and I'd listen to that track and kind of jot some things down. And you know, I'm trying to kind of convey the essence of what my daughter, you know, meant to me on some level, while kind of reaching back, I guess, into into my past and, you know, talking about the, oh, I know, I had a concert back in the town that I was born in that previous fall. And I hadn't been back there in a long time. Vermilion, South Dakota. So the song starts, you know, the going back to my old hometown. And that's where I got that, and I just kind of went from there. And then I hadn't been to the Tour de France by then, but I'd gotten pretty caught up in the Lance Armstrong. He lives here. And the cancer and recovery story and his book had just come out. That's right. His book had just come out, and I had read the book. And so that kind of made its way into that song, too.
You've said in other interviews that it's been hard to write about the parenting. Is it still true, or is it... Why do you think it's hard? Is it just too deep?
Yeah, it's just... It's like I'm too new at it, and it's too deep. When you've been around the block with something a bit, you know, most songs work best if you're approaching something that deep. Do you come at it sideways? You don't write about parenthood. You write, my traveling companion is 9 years old. He's the child of my first marriage. And you're like, okay, that says, you know what I mean? You get a lot there. You know, the parents are divorced. They're on this trip. They're going to Graceland. We all believe, you know, he came at it sideways. It's in there. And, you know, and obviously some things have failed, you know. So you just touch on things, you know, here and there. But to write about it as an entire subject is too overwhelming. And I've, you know, only been at it for 6.5 years, so I'm starting to be able to come at it sideways.
When I said that to a friend of mine, they pointed out to a cover you did of a Greg Brown tune that I haven't heard yet on the Greg Brown tribute album. Is that a song that touches that theme at all?
There's probably better Greg Brown songs, but he wrote so beautifully about having a kid who's sick. I don't mean, you know, like a terminally ill child, but just it's a very lovely little piece about being in the middle of the night when your kid's got a fever. And he's got this little passage in there where he says, I mean, there's kind of a verse form and everything, and then he's got this little passage where it's like, I'm going to take you down to the ocean, and I'm going to throw you in, and you're going to become a dolphin, and you're going to go swimming out in the warm water, and then you're going to come back to me. And, that just kills me, you know, like remembering being a kid and being sick and having a fever, and it's almost like a little fever dream, you know, of, you know, you kind of go places when you're trying to get out of your misery. And just that beautiful idea of making your kid well by, I don't know, just some little fantasy to make them better, you know. And then he's got a great line in there about putting on Aretha Franklin because it's going to make her feel better than any medicine that she's going to. It's just beautiful song. He's written some great songs about being a parent. You know, he's been able to get it.
Well, and then finally, I'll just go full circle then, because the first line of Diamonds in the Rough, you know, talks about that moment where a child, it would be so cruel to bury that jewel. And I'm just, you know, wondering if that concept guides your parenting a bit and how you're bringing up your daughter. You know, to be cautious not to do that with her.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I think, like a lot of my generation, I probably want to try too hard to be less, you know, strict. You know, it's like every generation swings the other way. And, you know, you find out that there's a really important reason for boundaries. So it's been a pretty big challenge to, especially because, you know, I have a kid that's a lot like me, which is exactly what I would have wanted. And so that means there's, you know, a lot of energy and a lot of emotion, a lot of intensity. And it's been a challenge, you know, to like respect the energy and the emotion and the intensity of it and keep myself together and rein her in when it's appropriate. And, you know, because it'd be great if you could just say, oh, well, you know, I know what you're feeling. And what you don't know when you have this idea that you're going to parent your kid differently is, you know, they're not going to understand your language or your, you know. So, I don't know, I'm just kind of rambling about it. But sometimes I just, you know, the biggest challenge I think is just to let her feel what she's going to feel and let her be unhappy, you know, like in that emotion and just let it be. It's hard to see your kid uncomfortable.
But it's like relationships in general. We want to try to jump in and fix everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that never really works out most of the time because the person that you're interacting with isn't asking to have it
fixed.
Nobody's
asking to be fixed. Yeah, yeah. It's true.
You just want to be heard.